you are now well equipped to litigate cases in Pericles and Athens, aside from certain linguistic limitations. I think this is the most elaborate legal, less elaborately recorded legal system we've really looked at. I don't know if any of you tried reading the whole book, which is quite a lot of fun, but beyond what was assigned. As usual, I thought I would start with your comments and questions and discussion, and then go on to various notes I've got on things of interest. So your turn first. Are there things that struck people that they wanted to talk about? Yes.
Having not read the whole book, of the areas that you highlighted, what were the reasonings behind those sections?
One of the things I was thinking about, actually, looking at sort of the book and the notes versus my chapter, which you're reading for next time, is trying to figure out how in each of these chapters I'm selecting from a much larger body of stuff. And I guess the answer is I'm trying to find features of the legal system that are interesting, that I can make sense of, that do or don't parallel other legal systems. There's an awful lot more in that. I mean, if you look, I got on the syllabus a link to my outline of the whole book, which I did a few years ago when I was doing it. You can sort of get some idea there of how much it covers. One other thing I should mention is that linked to the outline at the bottom of it is a link to a web page with a good deal of information on sort of prices and wages in Pericles and Athens. Because one of the things that's worth trying to do when you're looking at these historical systems is figure out what's a large amount of money or not. So that when you're told, for example, that a magistrate could fine you up to 50 drachma without a court trial, just as sort of an administrative punishment, is that a slap on the wrist or a serious punishment? And similarly, the 1,000 drachma fine for prosecuting a hopeless case, basically, how large is that? So that's sort of relevant information, and I didn't mention it. You wouldn't know to look for it because you got to click on the link to the outline. Maybe I should have a direct link to it, but if you go down the outline, you'll find at the bottom of it a link to someone else's, I think, webpage that has a bunch of that information. So really, I was trying to, I guess, partly focus on stuff that would give you some idea of how the system worked or how the trials worked and how they classified cases. I thought the whole family law stuff was intriguing because it seems, I guess, alien would be the, I mean, it's, my reaction to reading about family law stuff is less this is good or bad than these people are from Mars. Right? This is a society where, at least until very near the end, it doesn't seem to occur to them that a woman could have an opinion about who she wants to be married to. Right? And that I gather from his comments that sort of late in the period you had this sort of radical new idea of love having nothing to do with marriage, I guess, coming in. But that prior to that, presumably a father cares that his daughter is well taken care of and such. But how does he do that? He marries her to somebody who will do a good job of, you know, maintaining her. But it's mostly seen in terms of the household and, you know, who is an authority over what, and a bunch of other stuff.
Aren't most societies patriarchal?
I think they are, but I'm not sure. That is, I'm pretty sure that in English society for many hundreds of years back, the woman's consent was a requirement for marriage. Her father's consent was probably also a requirement. And there are certainly lots of societies in which marriages are normally arranged by the family. I'm not even sure if it's a bad system. One of the more interesting experiences I once had many years ago was I was flying from Bombay to Australia. And in the airport while I was waiting, I got into a conversation with an Indian woman who seemed quite friendly and interesting, and we ended up sitting next to each other and talking a good deal of the way. And she was from southern India. She was clearly sort of an intelligent, educated woman from a very traditional society. And she was flying to Australia to join her husband, who was a physician. Her husband had been selected for her by her family. They had a chance to meet and socialize, and presumably she could have vetoed the choice if she wanted, but the normal assumption was it was the family and not she. And she found our system just as weird and puzzling as I found hers. And part of what was really intellectually interesting about this is that we're used to seeing foreign systems, you know, being portrayed in books and things. And it's easy then to say to yourself, well, if I could just talk to those people, you know, in 10 minutes I could show them how absurd their system was. Well, I could talk to her and I could do no better, slightly worse job, because my first marriage is just broken up then. So insofar as we had evidence from our small sample, her system was working better than ours. So that was really quite interesting. But this, I mean, various features of the Athenian system, I think my chapter I described it as the legal system of a mad economist, because parts of it have this sort of applying rationality to human behavior, but in a way which sometimes seems sort of very academic and maybe out of touch with how people actually feel, the whole business of torturing slaves, which is one of the puzzles in the system. But at other points, you're saying, well, aren't these clever people? I mean, isn't this an elegant solution? I mean, one of the ones I really like is you have this problem, which we have in lots and lots of systems, of people falsely charging other people or convicting them. And one of the points I have a chapter on somewhere is you need an incentive to prosecute. But any incentive to prosecute means the person who does the prosecuting benefits by doing it. That means he has an incentive to prosecute people whether or not they're guilty. And one of the features of the Athenian system, if I've got it right, is that if somebody had robbed you and you could prove it, you not only got the possession back, you got, I think, twice its value, if I got it right, as a penalty. And how do you find out whether he's robbed you? You search his house, but that's an opportunity to plant the evidence. We suspect this happens nowadays with drug cases, that police, for one reason or another, plant drugs on people that they want to convict, either because they want to get appropriate number of convictions this month, or because if they can prove that you are guilty of a crime, they can use that to pressure you into testifying against him, various reasons. So the Athenians see this problem in their context, and they've got this simple and very Greek solution, which is you're entitled to search his house, but you've got to do it stark naked. And so lots of things sort of that I found intriguing. And I was trying, given the length of the book, I was trying to cut it down to a point where I had a reasonable chance people would actually read the assigned reading, which if I give them the whole book, I suspect many of them won't. I hope that, you know, some of you will find it intriguing enough to want to read chunks other than what were assigned. But those I thought were enough so that you got a sort of a reasonable picture of the system. Yep.
Sorry, I was so yep. I guess my question is kind of based on the paper as well. Are you choosing sections that are of interest to you in particular, or is it more, you know, in designing these chapters? So for the book.
I'm trying to choose the things that will give you a picture of this society and its legal system, supplemented by the chapter that you're also going to read, which is sort of my selection, but not, I'm much less expert, obviously, than this author, and so I want you to be able to see, unfiltered by me, his picture.
So not necessarily sections that tie it to the other legal system?
Don't have to. Some of the things that I note are things that are the same or different from other legal systems. Some are things that have to do with the internal structure. I mean, ideally what I want for the book I'm writing is what I think of as threads of common issues that run through it. And some of them seem to be pretty obvious, like the incentive to prosecute problem. And others a little less obvious, like how religion ties into many different legal systems. But there are going to be others that I haven't spotted yet, as it were. And so part of it is just sort of trying to make sense of it and seeing what pings, as it were, what comes out. So, you know, I'm assuming most of your papers you're going to be finding legal systems of your own, and that it's going to be a first pass, in a sense. I mean, several of my chapters, I started out with student papers, but then I did a whole bunch more writing and thinking and mostly reading further sources on them. So it's not that I expect you to have a finished, complete version or something, but you ought to have an account as best you can tell of how a legal system worked and whatever interesting things you can say about it. And that's going to depend on the particular system, obviously. Yes?
But then I have actually a question about the content.
Yes, right.
So is this the first legal system that we've seen that has sort of required altruism?
Where are you thinking of required altruism?
In the wealthier poor.
I see. It's not altruism. The tax system isn't altruism.
Well, it seems like it was sort of a...
It's altruist only when you do it when you're not forced. Yeah, that's right. But the question is that the only system in which richer people are expected to bear a heavier part of the burden? And that's an interesting question if I think about the systems we look at. It isn't. It is not true of the Icelandic system. The closest you come to that, I think, in the Icelandic system is that you sometimes get a pattern of somebody taking over a law case sort of out of some combination of generosity and the desire to show, you know, that he can win it. And so those presumably are going to be richer people in the sense of people with more resources for using force.
I have a condom example. During the period of English that we're studying, English law, it was an obligation of some members of the aristocracy to field military units, and they had to clothe and arm these units.
This was as late as the 18th century still?
Still the 1700s.
So yeah. Well, of course, England in the 18th century certainly had taxes. And if I think about it, that's Adam Smith's century. So he has a long discussion of different possible taxes, and they include things like taxes on the value of a house, taxes on carriages. Smith's first maxim of taxation is that tax incidence should be proportional to income. That's not the language he uses. He's not arguing for an income tax. He, in fact, dismisses on different grounds almost all possible taxes on income, the only exception being taxes on the income of government employees. But you can still say, what's the incidence? Whatever you tax, how much will the people end up paying? And there his maxim is it should be in proportion to their revenues. And there's one passage people sometimes quote where he says a particular tax is going to bear more heavily on the rich, and that's not intolerable because, you know, the rich have an easier time with it. But he's not really arguing it's a virtue, he's just arguing it's an acceptable thing for a tax that's otherwise desirable. But he's taxing luxuries. So I guess the answer is that we didn't really discuss the tax system at all in the English. It won because that was what we were looking at, but that was a system in which people paid taxes, and presumably some of the taxes would have borne more heavily on the rich than the poor, and others might not have. You don't know.
I didn't even see it as a tax system, but now that you say that, it's more of a disproportionate tax on.
That's right. It's a somewhat odd way of taxing people, and I think the place where altruism, though I'm not sure even altruism is the right term, comes in, is it sounds as though people sometimes volunteer for one of these things they weren't obliged to do. But even then, my suspicion is that this is less altruism than glory hunting, so to speak. That they're showing off. They're saying, look, I'm rich, I'm able, this festival is going to be really good if I run it, and I'll get respect and status out of that. I don't know, you could argue that maybe altruism is about getting status, I don't know. I've certainly seen the argument made by critics of some sort of policy positions that the people who support these positions don't really care whether they help the people they claim to help. All they care is that they can get the status of feeling we're good, generous people. Yeah, I'm thinking actually of Tom Sowell, who's got a quite depressing book called Something of the Elect, where he's basically arguing that liberals do things that actually have very bad consequences and don't worry about it, don't pay attention to it, because they're on to patting themselves on the back of the next thing. I only read the beginning of the book. I wasn't sure he was right. It was a pretty depressing story of the society I live in. But Rand could easily make a similar kind of argument. Except that Rand, of course, is against altruism. But she's against altruism as she defines it. So that as she defines it, altruism really means making yourself worse off. Means sacrificing your values for someone else's benefit. And Rand, in fact, we know from her surviving correspondence, subsidized the schooling of a relative of hers. And it's pretty clear from the correspondence that she didn't at all want it to be felt that she was obliged to do so. But she chose to do so. But she would have said that wasn't altruism, because she was promoting her own values by what she was doing, and similarly with other cases. But not altruism. But I think there is some redistributionist element in this system, and that particular system is a redistributionist element in it. Now, it presumably is interesting because you could argue that it's partly that, but there's maybe a different function, which is the idea that wealthy people are probably relatively confident of doing things in a society, and you don't have a, you know, this is a society where all of the officials are serving for 1 year terms elected by random by law. So it's not like you have a professional bureaucracy to do stuff. And it might make sense to say, well, look, we appoint this wealthy person to be in charge of our team at the Olympics, and what's going to happen? A, he's going to use the abilities that made him wealthy, if we're lucky, to do a good job of making Athens look good by having a good team at the Olympics, which is not just winning, but also display and stuff like that. He's going to do it in, he's going to save as much money as he can, subject to doing a good job, because it's his own money. So you might even think of it as sort of a clever kind of a substitute for having a bureaucracy to do something. It's a little bit like the negative version of that is Roman tax farming, which is you don't have an IRS, so how do you collect taxes from the province? You auction off the right to be the person who collects and pockets all of the taxes from a province, subject to whatever the laws are on taxes. Whoever is the highest bidder pays you the lump sum that is what he was willing to pay for that right, and then he goes and collects the taxes, so you don't need it for that purpose, at least, an imperial bureaucracy. And there are obviously disadvantages to that system as well, but it's intriguing if you think of sort of the different ways that different societies have solved those problems. So you had something you wanted to raise.
Yeah, actually, I was just looking at the website on the handout. I mean, yeah. A 500 drachma is a decent year's salary, so...
Yes.
I mean, it's more than subsistence. It's substantially more than subsistence. Subsistence would be on the order of 200 drachma a year.
Yeah, and it sounded as though the wage for an ordinary worker at various times is about 1 to 2.5 drachma a day. But then if you, I don't know if it's there or I've got elsewhere, there are various figures at much higher ends for the expenditures of the Athenian state, which were very large, for how large an income it took to be in various categories of the army, and so forth.
Talent is huge. Talent is 100,000 drachma.
Yep.
Or something like that.
I don't remember what the amount
talent
is.
Talent is not something you want to be facing. Yep.
It's a sizable chunk of silver, I think.
The other thing I have was that this quote from Demosthenes, which is in the book, is really astounding when he says, "Witnesses have sometimes been found not to have given true evidence, whereas no statements made by as a result of torture have ever been proved to be untrue."
Yes.
The reason why that's so amazing is because Demosthenes is speaking in the year roughly 330. Huh. And this system has been in place in Athens for at least 150 years, yes, if not longer. During that entire time, torture is regarded as successful and completely accurate.
I don't believe it. You mean that Demosthenes says that torture is completely accurate? But Demosthenes is a liar.
Well,
okay. No, it's not the case to Demosthenes, but as I think I commented in the chapter, there is a book which has a bunch of orations. See, one of the main sources for information is surviving orations, because what happens is that you're either a prosecutor or a defendant. You are expected to plead your own case. It is, in fact, illegal to be a lawyer. It's illegal to pay somebody to speak for you.
It's by rhetoric. It's a class.
Although you can... But what you can do is you can pay someone like Demosthenes to write an oration for you that you then memorize and deliver. And some of these orations, as literary creations, have survived. And it happens that there is a pair of orations written by the same orator for two different cases, in one of which he makes some version of Demosthenes' claim about how reliable torturing of slaves is for a source of information, and in the other of which he makes the argument about why it's a completely unreliable method, because of course the slave will say whatever the torturer wants him to say. So I thought that was just beautiful. You've got the orator. That it's not that they're stupid. They see. It's a puzzle. I mean, I was going to get to it later. The whole business of torturing slaves is an interesting puzzle. Why did they think it worked? But it's clear that it wasn't that it hadn't occurred to them that there was a problem with it. Because it looks to me as though anybody who wanted to, for example, refuse to let his slaves be tortured, or who wanted to question evidence produced in this way, makes the one argument, and anybody on Demosthenes' side makes the other. Now, I'm somewhat prejudiced against Demosthenes, being a Mary Renault fan, and he doesn't come across very well in her writing.
He's arguing against Philip the Great of Macedon, so...
yeah. Something I should mention, if people would like a very vivid picture of these societies, Mary Renault is one of the great historical novelists of the 20th century. Well, I don't think she's alive anymore. And most of her stuff is set in Greece in classical antiquity. And they're good books. They're interesting books. And they're perceptive books, I think, on a lot of different things. One of the things she wrote, three-book series on Alexander the Great, of which the third one starts at his death. It's called Funeral Games, and it's about the breakup of the empire and the struggle among his various generals for pieces of it. And Ptolemy is, I suppose, insofar as he's a hero of that book, and he's the guy who knows exactly what he wants, and he takes it and he keeps it, namely Egypt. But in that one, you can see sort of a picture of the society. And the Alexander one, Demosthenes was sort of the great opponent in Athens of Philip, and thus, I guess, really Philip more than Alexander's father. And Renault is an admirer of Alexander and to some extent of Philip, and portrays them. And she's got one scene where Demosthenes, I think the Athenian army just been defeated, if I remember correctly, by the Macedonians, and Demosthenes is running away. And he encounters some other Athenians who tell him, no, but Demosthenes gave this great speech about how we shouldn't run away. And he doesn't, I think, tell them who he is, and he keeps running, basically. So he's not an attractive character in that one in lots of ways. But whether she's right, I don't know. But my impression is that Renault, in some ways, identifies with classical Greek society and culture more than with the society she lived in, which is one of the things that makes it an interesting story. But anyway, that would be a feeling. So other points for you before I go back to some of the things I was... Yes?
500 jurors? That was just an extremely high number.
Yes. And sometimes more.
Yeah. I want to know how many cases we're talking about times 500 jurors. Yes?
What we know is that the total panel was 6,000 people.
Okay, but they can be recycled, though, right?
That is, they hear more than one case a day, obviously, let alone one case a year. Sure. But that means that at any given time, they presumably were only listening to about 10 cases. And if you figure one to four cases a day, say, which is the impression I get, I don't know what the actual figures are, that means that you could have up to maybe 40 cases a day. Not all courts met all the time, but still, it could easily be thousands of cases a year.
Wow. Okay.
One of the things that struck me about that system, one way of looking at the jury system was it was their version of welfare. That is to say, the payment was half a drachma. I think it did go up maybe to two-thirds of a drachma, I think. I'm not sure, but anyway, it was something like half.
From 2 obols to 3 obols.
And 3 obols is a drachma?
Is half a drachma.
Half a drachma, right. So it went from a third to a half a drachma a day. So it's less than a worker would earn, but maybe half what a worker would earn. So you can think of that as sort of a bare survival rate for an elderly man who doesn't have a job kind of thing. And so 6,000 people... I think I've got some estimates somewhere, maybe not, I don't know if I have the estimates of anything on the web or not for the total population, but you know what the estimates are? 100,000 citizens? I don't...
Yeah, something like that. I've got citizens total, 500,000 total people, including Mitis and whatnot.
Yeah, I worked out or found estimates at some point. They may be on the stuff I linked to, I don't remember. Suppose it's 100,000 citizens. 100,000, suppose we're 100,000 male citizens for a moment, because that's who the jurors are, then that would be 6% of them. And that's probably a high estimate for male citizens. So maybe 8 or 10% of the people were jurors, and that's your welfare system. But another way of looking at it is that that's their equivalent of baseball and football. Right? That here, a whole bunch of people who don't have much to do are sitting there in this sort of somewhat exciting business of hearing orators in some case or other and making a decision and all the rest of it.
My next question actually has to do with jurors as well.
Yep.
I think a lot of comparing that system to our own system, I think we place a premium on amateur jurors. And I know a lot of judges distrust jurors, especially amateurs as jurors. But I think one of the ways we cure the problem is that we like we had this sense about serving on a jury as like a solemn duty. Like we talk about it almost religiously. Like it's your duty to be on a jury. It's your civic duty.
Right.
But if you hear that in cases, it seems like some of the mysticism would be taken out of it. Yep. Do they do anything to reinforce their jurors?
Not that I know of. That is, they had elaborate procedures to try to keep them from being bribed. But other than that, as far as I can tell, it was basically anybody who volunteered up to the total number. Yeah, I think so. But it was sort of an uncertain job, because you didn't know that you'd be called on any particular day, depending on how many cases there were. But yes.
We view the jury system as a quid pro quo. Because we demand a jury trial, that means you as citizens have to serve on the jury. Otherwise, you can't have jury trials. And so since the one goes to the other, they're literally linked.
But you could have a system with jury trials in which you paid whatever wage was necessary to get people to agree to be jurors.
Okay, that's true.
I mean, that's like saying you can't have an army without a draft. It's one way of doing it, but it's not the only way.
That's a matter of, but you need to have citizens in order to have a jury. I mean, the definite jury is an honest, representative group of your fellow citizens who are empowered.
It's not representative in this case, and arguably it's not representative in our case for other reasons.
I had two other questions. Yeah. First one was the miasma.
Yes.
That I talked about.
Yes.
Did they have anything like the gypsies had to clean or to cleanse an infection?
I think the answer is yes, but I am not positive. I think that there are ceremonies in the temples which would get you on miasma, but I doubt it would work for somebody who committed murder, though I'm not sure.
Well, what I was worried about is
people who
are affected by a murderer.
The answer is I'm not certain, but I think so. You could look through and see. Because if you look up miasma in the index, you would see whether he discusses it anywhere, but I'm not sure.
But certainly, it's
very common in societies to have cleansing rituals of some sort, so I'd be surprised if they didn't. Yep.
My second question had to do with one part it said, a dying man could assign his wife and dowry to another.
Yes.
Or specify in his will who they were to go to.
Right.
Did you have any anecdotes to illustrate that, or was it, was that a common thing? Was that not so common?
I'm pretty sure that one or more of the cases they mention, that happens. Now, obviously, the person it's assigned to doesn't have to accept. Right? Marriage was voluntary on the part of the man, though not the woman, from the descriptions. That seems... And you can certainly see, if you're thinking of it sort of from a paternalistic standpoint, you could say, I want to have my wife taken care of. He's a nice guy. He's competent. He's got a reasonable income. He can take care of her. So I'm going to see if he'll do it. That's one of the things which I think is one of the things you read, which was sort of interesting, is one of these cases where you've got two heiresses who are really heiresses to nothing. That is to say, the estate may even have a negative value. It's not clear. And one of the cousins or something, or the closest male heirs, saying to the other, look, we've got an obligation to their father who's died. They're our relatives. We would have been happy to marry them. They've been rich. We ought to be willing to marry, to take care of these girls if they're poor. You take one, I'll take the other kind of thing. So that's sort of a sense. Again, the opinion of the girl isn't being solicited. It's sort of weird, because you would think at least they would say, well, look, which of us do you want with which of you? Because they're presumably different people. But there's no implication, at least in that passage, that question even occurs to them. I think that's something that could happen. I'm trying to remember, but the answer is that you'd have to go through the book and see whether, because he has various inheritance and related cases. So I think there are some that have that pattern, but I'm not sure. And I have no. The thing is, we really don't have statistics, right? It's not like you could say this happens in X percent of the cases. It's a tangent, but something I was noticing online where somebody was talking about CPR, coronary pulmonary resuscitation. This is an essay by a doctor who was basically talking about how doctors die. And his point was that doctors are much less likely than other people to be in favor of sort of heroic measures to keep them alive, because they know that what you're doing is trading quality of life for a fairly short extension of life. And one of the things the article mentioned was that somebody had looked at incidents of CPR on television programs. And that it was like on television programs that 60% of the people fully recovered, and I don't remember the details. And then you look at the real data. And the real data is like 8% survive, and most of them end up seriously with serious medical problems thereafter. I think that was the number. I don't know where it was. But again, it was just sort of struck by the degree to which one's perception of something may or may not really correspond to the data. I mean, similarly, my impression, though I may be wrong, is that a large majority of all criminal cases are plea bargained. Is that right? Anybody know? In our system. And yet our sort of standard model is still the Perry Mason model, as it were, of what's that?
More than what?
95%. Yeah. Right. Right. So in this case, we have very fragmentary evidence, but we've got a bunch of literary stuff. We've got plays, and, you know, plays are not going to be literally accurate, but they're going to show sort of how the society looked from the inside and get some feeling, and I think it's one of the plays that's the evidence that towards the end of this period, some people actually thought that whether a couple were in love with each other had something to do with whether they ought to get married or not, because there's one of these heiress cases where I think she was planning to marry somebody, and then her father dies, and this old man who's the nearest relative wants her, and people are trying to persuade him to let her marry the guy she wants to marry. The interesting thing there was that the person who's trying to persuade him, who I think is the stepfather of the other alternative husband, is saying, look, you can take the money, just let him marry the girl, and his reply basically is, yeah, and then they have a kid, and the kid sues me on the grounds that I've ended up with property that properly belongs to him. You can't do that. And I thought that was intriguing, that sort of the limits of freedom of contract in trying to avoid the logic of the system, assuming it was right. So other things, yeah.
I was wondering about the public prosecution, because it mentioned it in several times throughout the book, and then it mentioned the procedure of it at the very end, and it seemed like it was something that only occurred when one of the parties was a public figure of some kind, like a magistrate, or they were like taking care of
it. I'm not sure what you say, public. We've really, the two main cases are private cases and public cases, but a public case here is privately prosecuted, almost always. The closest thing to a civil criminal distinction, to a tort criminal distinction in their system, is a case where only the person who claims to have been injured or his representative can prosecute, and a case where essentially any adult male citizen can prosecute. And then there's a much smaller number of cases where a magistrate prosecutes, and I think that's what you're thinking of. So that basically, if I understand at least his interpretation of what happened, you start out with a system where the magistrates are prosecuting. And that then goes to the possibility that you can always appeal the magistrate's verdict to the assembly of the citizens. But that's not really workable. I think this happens before what you read, if I remember correctly. But that's not really workable because the assembly of the citizens is too many people. So they get this great idea, how about a jury acting as a proxy for the assembly of the citizens? And they then think of the jury as sort of somehow representing the people of Athens, even though it's only a small subset of them. And once you have that, there's not a whole lot of point in the magistrate doing the trial himself, because it'll just get appealed to the jury. So now the magistrate in the normal case is just handling the mechanics, as it were. A private volunteer prosecutor is prosecuting, and the jury is deciding. And then there are a few special cases where the magistrate still is himself the prosecutor. And I think that's what you're thinking of that they're discussing at the end.
What I was trying to figure out, though, was what this... Because, as you said, most of the public prosecution cases were actually privately prosecuted.
Yes.
So what... I couldn't... From the reading, I couldn't really figure out the distinction between the public prosecution...
Yes, let me see. Let me take a look at that. Because the answer is that I do not remember... I remember that they make that distinction, and I was just trying to see if I could find where they... Do you remember exactly where it was in the final reading?
Yeah. I want to figure out what the distinction between public prosecution cases and private prosecution cases were.
Like, what was the procedure, or how were they distinguished?
Yeah, how were they distinguished?
He actually talks about it in his chapter. A public case corresponded roughly to our criminal case it was supposed to be for an offense that injured not merely a single person, but in some sense the community as a whole.
Yeah, but the question is not that. The question is, among those cases, which were the minority that were actually prosecuted by a magistrate as opposed to the usual pattern which is prosecuted by a public prosecutor, by a volunteer prosecutor? And that's, I think, at the end of the book. Yes. Sometimes the magistrate himself noticed an offense concerning his own sphere of responsibility. For example, a general might need to prosecute for desertion from the army. If the offense required a penalty greater than the magistrate could impose on his own authority, he had to introduce the case into court for trial by jury. A group of magistrates who had virtually no function except to prosecute was the 10 synagoroi, who presented the case against any ex-magistrate who was being prosecuted on a financial charge at his euthena. That basically what's happening is at the end of your year as a magistrate, you're sort of giving an accounting of what you've done, and people can prosecute on the ground you've done something. And for that, there was a set of special magistrates to prosecute the magistrates. Another kind of synagorus was a man appointed by the ecclesia or the bull to speak for the prosecution in a particular case. When the ecclesia or the bull passed a decree, this is basically the assembly, ordering that someone should be tried. So the assembly could basically indict you. The decree would state who was to prosecute at the trial. In practice, this would often be the man who had originally raised the matter, but it was quite possible for the ecclesia or the bull to appoint other speakers for the prosecution.
So then, as I understand it, there didn't even need to be a prosecutor in case the court could just decide.
Not the court, the assembly.
The
Congress of all people, as it were. This is the whole population in theory. Of course, they aren't all going to be there. The ecclesia is the Athenian assembly to which every adult male citizen is entitled to be a member and vote.
On the other end of being prosecuted by the entire state, but not in a sense like we have a DA, but really like.
But rather, like Congress votes to indict you. Congress then appoints somebody who may be the guy who came to Congress and said, look, this is a bad guy who committed treason or something. And so they say, all right, he'll have the job of prosecuting you. So there are clearly a number of sort of special cases in which rather than a volunteer prosecutor, it's somebody, either a magistrate with the job of prosecuting this particular kind of thing, a general who prosecutes for desertion, or somebody appointed by the assembly. Other?
No. It's interesting. There are some famous examples in Athenian history where they made mistakes, where the juries came up with the wrong decision.
Yes.
And yet the Athenian response to this, rather than allowing, as we did in our system, of basically saying, we'll put a whole other level of checks and balances in the form of appeals onto court cases, the Athenian strategy is actually to make it more difficult for juror decisions to be reversed by a later vote. Mm. And as it says at the end of the book, there was a period of time when the assembly had the authority to basically override votes and say, no, cancel that. It's no longer a valid verdict. And they made it later on, and after the war, the Peloponnesian War, that became impossible, or nearly impossible.
But I don't think we know why. That is, the author thinks it's evidence they were satisfied that the juries were getting the right verdict, but it might also be that they were unhappy about the politicking in the assembly to acquit a guilty person who had enough votes, kind of thing. So I don't think we know that. Let me go back just for a moment to the sources that we have. There are some surviving texts of laws. There are about 100 orations from the law courts. There are references in comedies and histories and such to particular things that show it. We're concentrating on roughly Pericles to Demosthenes, about 435 to 322 in this book, basically because that's when most of our data are. When the book has a slashed date, 402 to 403, that's because their year was defined summer to summer, and therefore would cover parts of two of our years. And I think there also are some surviving objects that have parts of laws inscribed on them. There's only they've been stone inscriptions and things of that sort. Basically, legal status, you've got citizens, foreigners, and slaves. Normally, you're only a citizen if your father is a citizen, and after a while, only if both father and mother are citizens. But you didn't have to be legitimate to be a citizen, although you had to be legitimate, I think, to be a member of the household of your father, if I've got it correctly. There's some stuff which wasn't in what you read, but that was sort of interesting in that apparently prior to Solon, who was the famous lawgiver, second famous lawgiver, there were four hereditary tribes. And Solon reorganized the whole system, or at least so we're told, so that he put everybody in a deme, which you can think of as a parish, which was a geographical unit. And he then created 10 tribes, which were made up of demes in a non-geographical grouping. So this deme goes to tribe 1, this deme goes to tribe 2, this deme goes to tribe 3. And presumably it was an explicit attempt to avoid geographical partisanship kinds of feelings in the system. And the parts I and you read don't go into much detail, but the tribe system then in various places feeds into elements of the legal system. The tribes have arbitrators, for example, who settle certain kinds of cases. But to me, it felt in a sense very modern, sort of like the kind of thing that Rousseau might have proposed or Stalin might have done, where you say, well, here is your structure. We're going to just scrap the existing structure and redo it right this time. And, yeah, Brendan, you're right. It's a French Revolution kind of feeling. Other things that... I guess one of the particularly interesting things to me was the whole issue of the incentive for private prosecution, because that's a theme that sort of in some ways runs through the course in the book. And one possible incentive would be that you believed in justice and were outraged by something. Another possible is you wanted to get somebody. That the impression one gets sort of reading Athenian stuff was that it was a pretty contentious society, and there were a lot of people who hated other people for one reason or another. So I think one of Demosthenes' cases, if I remember correctly, is one where Demosthenes has been awarded a crown for service to the state, and somebody sues on the grounds that Demosthenes didn't serve the state and doesn't deserve the crown, and that was an actual law case. I think I've got it right, something close to that at least. But in any case, so there are possible incentives, but the other incentive is the share of the fine. That for most, although not all, categories of cases, if the verdict was a fine to the defendant, the prosecutor got a hefty chunk. I think the upper bound is 2/3, but I think more often half or a third of the fine. If the case is that the defendant owes something, owes property to the Athenian state, the plaintiff gets, I think it's half or 2/3 the value of the property if he wins and so forth. And it's fairly obvious what the problem is that that system raises. And again, these people were not stupid. It raises the problem of suing innocent people, either in the hope of winning or in the hope of getting paid to drop the case. All right, and this in a way feeds back into our 18th century English story, because I argue that one of the reasons, indeed, to prosecute guilty people in the criminal system was that you couldn't collect money by convicting them, but you might collect money for not convicting them, and that was a possible incentive. So the Athenian system tries to control this in three different ways. One of them, which I think is one of the sort of clever ideas that I wonder if some version of would work for us, is that if you can't get at least a fifth of the jurors to vote for conviction, obviously it was a meritless case, therefore you're at fault for bringing it, therefore you owe 1,000 drachma fine. And again, that's a fine of, say, upwards of 2 years' income for an ordinary random Athenian citizen. That was not true for all cases, but it was true for most classes of cases. And the suggestion in the book is that if they were particularly worried about some issue, they would say, all right, that one, even if you don't get 20%, you don't have to pay a penalty. But most things they didn't. But then the obvious solution, obvious at least to an 18th century Englishman and hopefully to us, is to say, all right, it's true, it's a little risky accusing you of this, but it's awful risky for you because you might get convicted, so I will agree to drop the charges for a suitable payment. They made that illegal. So did the English. All right, 18th century England, that was compounding a felony. It was legal for a misdemeanor to accept a payment to drop your charges. It was even approved of, apparently, but it was illegal for a felony. But if you wanted to evade that. You're an Athenian, what do? You're an Athenian prosecutor, the defendant has offered you a suitable bribe to drop your charges, and you say, but wait a minute, if I drop the charge, they will penalize me, that's an offense in this system. What do we do instead?
Claim you're sick.
Couldn't show up at the trial. Sorry, I was sick. I sent a friend to report that I was sick, and somehow or other, the defendant and the prosecutor never got together again to recommence the trial. And at least by his account, that was sort of the dodge by which you could have ended. Now, in addition to the fine for getting 20% and the penalty for dropping the case, there was also a third mechanism, which isn't explained very well. But apparently, you could prosecute somebody for sycophancy. Sycophant didn't mean what it means to us. It meant abusive prosecutor, basically. And the rule seems to have been that only three citizens and three medics could be so prosecuted each year. And it sounds as though they just don't know how we decided who got to prosecute whom, whether it was the first three to show up at the court or what. But at least in principle, being a sycophant was itself a crime, and therefore you could be prosecuted for that. And that struck me as sort of an intriguing feature. Looking at details that do or don't fit in the other systems, some of the things I noticed, one of them is that it looks as though, as in 18th century England, imprisonment is not a standard penalty, although he seems to think it occasionally occurred. But that mostly people are imprisoned while they're awaiting trial, when they have been assessed a fine and haven't paid it yet, things of that sort. And it sounds as though imprisonment was in the list of penalties, but was not does not seem to have been a very common one. That most of the penalties were fines, which has obvious attractions, since somebody gets to collect the fine, helps pay for the prosecutor, for one thing. Another thing that struck me as interesting was the role of oaths. And that's just sort of touched on very briefly, but we know that in Jewish law and in Muslim law, and I think in Somali law, if I remember correctly, the oath was actually a part of the legal procedure. There were certain circumstances in which if I was willing to take a suitable oath, I won a case, and if I was unwilling, I lost it. And the Athenian case doesn't carry it that far. Did people notice what the role of the oath was in the Athenian case as this is described? Because in a way, it fits with other features. What happens is I can challenge you to take a suitably powerful oath that what you're saying is true. You don't have to take it. But if you refuse to take it, I can introduce as evidence that you're lying to the jury the fact that you refuse to take it. So in that case, as in a number of other things, it's all really going to the jury, but assuming that people believe in the religion enough so that one is reluctant to swear to something that's false, is going to have at least some measure of providing a lie detector kind of function. My favorite oath one, which I think was the Somali one, is the one where you swear by your marriage, and if it later turns out the oath is false, you're automatically divorced. I think that's the only one that had that kind of system. But then in the Jewish one, if you're discovered to have sworn falsely, you can't swear in the future, and that's a legal handicap because there are cases where you need to swear an oath in order to win your case. So another thing I noticed, which parallels a little bit elements of some of the other system, is that for unintentional homicide, the normal penalty was exile, but it could be canceled if the kin of the victim agreed to let you back in. And in the Cheyenne stuff, which we're not doing this year, but at the point when someone has killed a Cheyenne, has been exiled automatically for doing it, and years later wants to petition to come back in, one of the things that will affect it is whether the kin of the person he killed say, all right, we're satisfied. Yeah?
Is there a rewrite where it said that the defendant, after the first day of evidence, could choose to just take exile?
Yeah.
What was the reasoning behind that?
Well, presumably one reason is to save the time and trouble of a trial, but another reason is that if you're really thinking of the objective as getting rid of him, exile may be just as good from the standpoint of the prosecution, and it's a whole lot better from the standpoint of the defendant. you might say, look, let's suppose we've got a two-thirds chance of convicting him. That might be sufficient reason for him to choose exile. And if we think he's guilty, we might think that a certainty of exile is better than a two-thirds chance of execution, with a one-third chance that he'll be around, he'll be suing us next time. That, and there's a lot of this, I think, is getting entangled with politics. If you think about how that system ran, I don't want to live in Pericles, Athens. Maybe I'm wrong, but my impression is that it demonstrates some of the downsides of democracy, in the sense of a system where any time that I can get enough of the mob on my side, I have the law on my side too, so to speak, and that's sort of scary. Our kids for some years were in a very small and unconventional private school, and it was run on two principles, one of which I liked. And the one I liked was it was an unschooling system. The kids basically only attended a class if they asked a staff member to teach a class on something. They were in control of their own time. So it was an extreme freedom unschooling model. The other was democracy, that basically the school was run by majority vote of, I think, the kids and the staff, as I remember. And that, in my view, part of the breakdown of that is part of the reason we eventually ended up leaving the school. That sort of, in theory, there were no compulsory classes, but in practice, unless you became reasonably skilled in small group politics, you were at the mercy of those people who were. So, anyway. Yeah?
The question on law in here, that where the comment said, unless there was a law, the case couldn't be brought.
Yeah.
I was trying to figure out what point you were really getting at.
The question is, they don't have common law, but for example, in the Chinese system, you could be accused of doing something that there was no statute against. You could be accused of violating an imperial decree where the decree didn't exist, where what that meant apparently was if the emperor had thought of it, he would have made a decree against this. And there's another one which is doing what ought not to be done. So that there were a couple, I think, of sort of blank forms by which if the court thought what you did was clearly bad, but there didn't happen to be an explicit statute against it, they could still get you. And I think what he has said, it sounds as though there was some question among the scholars as to whether that was the case in Athens, and he's arguing that it wasn't. He's arguing that the laws were broad enough so that most bad things you could find the law to prosecute somebody under, but you did have to do it, you had to do it partly for mechanical reasons, because how do you know what court to charge him in, or what magistrate's going to handle the case unless you know? That's part of what the law, just as in the Chinese system we haven't gotten to yet, part of what the statute specifies is the punishment. In the Athenian case, the law occasionally specifies the punishment, but often doesn't. But it has to specify, essentially, the court and the magistrate, because that tells you how you proceed, the procedure. So I think that was the point that he was making.
Where was the 30 tyrants in relation to Pericles?
Where was what?
In the timeline, 30 tyrants, is that before or after this period that we're
talking about? I think that's towards the end of it, if I've got it right, but I would have to look up to be sure.
30 tyrants is a brief period of time after the Peloponnesian War when the Spartans had won. Pericles died in 420. Athens loses the war in 405 or 403. Very brief period of time when Athens is full of chaos, a period of time of the 30 tyrants, and then it goes back to democracy. I think that's the timeline.
And I think the 30 tyrants are, I think, supported by Sparta, if I remember correctly. I think that's what's going on. But it's sort of interesting in a way, and I guess maybe creditable to the culture, I'm not sure, that here the Spartans had fought this very long war with Athens and its allies and won. And do they try to enslave all the Athenians? No. Do they try to, when the Athenians overthrow the oligarchy, do the Spartans come back and say, put it back? No. It's sort of, you know, it's over. Very odd.
Any vision on the part of the Spartans?
Maybe. Yeah, that's one way of looking at it.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah. My son's been reading the Greek historians in his class at Chicago. Has mixed opinions. I forget which one of them he thinks is pretty bad. I forget who. And one of them he thinks is pretty good.
Diodorus Siculus. Great fun. One of the things I really enjoyed was if you lost the case, you had to prepare. proposed the punishment.
Yes.
The prosecution proposed the punishment.
Yes.
And the jury voted for which one?
That's an elegant system. if you think about the fact that you've got a mechanism which is really designed to make binary decisions, yes or no, now you're putting the incentive on the parties to try to estimate about where the line will be drawn, so to speak.
Socrates' proposed punishment is out of proportion for what he's been accused of a crime, and this proposed punishment is that date of Athens should feed me for the rest of my life. It's like, come on, he could have proposed all sorts of things. I'll pay $1,000 fine, I'll agree not to teach for a year, but it's like, no, the state should feed me for a year.
Right. His view was
biggest mark against Socrates was that the great Athenian Alcibiades was a former
friend of his. Yeah.
And he turned against Athens and became a general of Sparta.
Did lots of things.
And then everyone wanted to kill him.
It's so funny, the end. And Alcibiades dies in Persia, if I remember correctly. He's been an interesting character. Another point that struck me again, which we've mentioned already, but was sort of similar to other things, is the whole business of miasma, this idea of pollution and the way in which it feeds in to the system. And it's sort of hard to know in a lot of these things whether you want to think of this as a case of religion changing the law or of the law making use of the religion as a tool. And yet it does seem to be a very common pattern. I don't know what it goes back to. Maybe it's somehow related to hunter-gatherers observing the spread of disease and then generalizing from that to other disease-like things somehow. I'm not sure, but it seems pretty common. You will notice that the age of majority for women seems to be 14, at least from one reference. That's the point at which marriages actually happen. In general, one of the impressions you get reading this stuff is that our society is out of line historically in age of both men and women in thinking of adulthood as something like 18 to 21 instead of physical maturity, puberty at something like 13, 14, which is the Jewish pattern and the pattern apparently.
How do you have to be down to 12? Because that's when you become in modern society, events changes in diet, God knows what else.
I was reminded in the whole discussion of the status of women of Joan Baez's song, "Oh, hard is the lot of all womankind. She's always oppressed, she's always confined, confined by her parents until she's a wife, a slave to her husband the rest of her life." And that's pretty close. I mean, not literally slave, but she always has a lord, and it's her father until she's married, and her husband after she's married, and maybe her son if her husband dies. Which was intriguing.
That's true in China as well. Absolutely same.
One of the other things, which I gather is still true, at least de facto in Texas, is that if you find the seducer in flagrante delicto with not only your wife, but your wife, mother, daughter, or sister, you can kill him on the spot. I don't think it's legally true in Texas, but they say that this is actually true in Texas. But the other thing, of course, the Athenians are practical people, is you can also tie him up and then say, well, look, I got the right to kill you. What will you pay me to let you go? Which sounds as though it sometimes happens. Or you can just beat him up and try to shame him and embarrass him and things of that sort. And I thought one thing that was sort of neat, but again makes sense, is that seduction is a more serious crime than rape. In their world, it makes perfectly good sense because it's not really a crime against the woman. And from the standpoint of her husband, if your wife has been raped, you can still trust her. It wasn't her fault. If she's been seduced, you can never trust her again. It's a much more serious injury to you. And therefore, you sort of reverse what seems to our moral intuitions the appropriate scale of punishment. Some other interesting things are, again, going back to the question of how you have an incentive not to engage in abusive litigation, is that in some of what we would call tort cases, did you notice what happens if you lose? You owe the defendant a sixth of the amount you claimed. And it's apparently not clear in the records whether this happens any time you lose or whether it's again a get fewer than 20% of the, fewer than a fifth of the votes. We don't know that. But it does make a certain amount of sense, and you could imagine maybe that's something we ought to introduce, to say that when you sue, you specifically claim how much money you're claiming. Court can't give you more than that amount, and if you lose, or if you lose overwhelmingly, you owe a penalty that's proportionate to that claim. That would be sort of a neat way of preventing strategies of overclaiming. Now, ideally, of course, you'd like to have a criminal version of that, too. You'd like to say that if the DA accuses somebody of murder, and really, the reason he accused him of murder was he thought he was guilty of manslaughter, and you get a plea bargain for manslaughter by accusing him of murder, and the defendant has got the guts to go to trial and wins, the DA ought to be jailed for 6 months. All right? You could imagine some variant of that, some system in which you punish people in the criminal as well as the tort system for overclaiming their charges. Now, how you could make it work, well, I'm not sure. I've got my doubts that that particular proposal would fly, but it does seem to me it's a kind of issue worth thinking about.
Well, it's a cost for the DA to charge him.
That's right.
It's not their money they're spending. It's not their time.
Well, that's not quite right, because the DA has other people they'd like to convict, and he's got a limited amount of resources. So the more resources he spends on you, the fewer he has you for other cases. So it's not quite true. But
because it would ruin your life for a period of years at virtually no cost themselves, and if you are eventually proven innocent, the state says, oh, great, you were innocent. Fine.
Yep. Yes.
You didn't die.
So an interesting question is, are there ways, that is, in the case of a tort case, civil cases, a judge can award costs, which is one way of penalizing somebody for abusive litigation. And you can countersue, of course, which is another way. But I'm not sure that there's really any mechanism in criminal law. So that's an interesting thing to think about for both civil and criminal, if you're trying to imagine reforming our system, whether there are ways in which you could penalize that sort of behavior. Number of other neat things. Something I thought was sort of neat is, suppose you're taken prisoner, you're an Athenian, you're taken prisoner in war. And so that means that the other side is going to enslave you. And in fact, the value of you to yourself is greater than the value of you as a slave to somebody else. So obviously the efficient transaction to somehow buy you back. But there are certain practical problems with your getting at your assets when you're a slave somewhere else. So what is their solution to that? Some other Athenian goes to the people who got you and ransoms you, pays the sum which will they'll return you. At which point, how does he make sure you pay him back? Anybody pick up on that? I sort of liked it. You're now his slave until you reimburse him for what he spent to ransom you. So that's sort of an intriguing idea of, you know, it sort of almost reminds me of the whole issue of how do we enforce your student loans. All right? If you've got a loan where what you bought with the loan is human capital, then if it's treated like an ordinary loan, after you accumulate it, you graduate, and you declare bankruptcy and start with a clean slate. And you're not allowed to. So in a certain sense, you are the slave of the lender in the sense that he has a claim that can't be escaped in bankruptcy until you pay back the money. I hope all of you are considering this when deciding whether and how much student loans to take out. But it does just strike me sort of an interesting and typically ingenious solution.
I thought it was interesting how easily you could switch become being a free to slave again. There are ways in which you become free and you can now become a slave. If you paid off your owner and then fail to pay certain additional costs or fail to pay the whole amount, and then they can say, well, you know, you didn't finish paying off, you're a slave again.
Yep. Yes. Like, yes. But one of the general issues that struck me interesting, because it's an issue which I don't discuss in the book, but probably should, in lots of systems, is how you deal with whether testimony is true or false. Did people follow? He mentions, at least briefly in what you read, but I think at greater length elsewhere, what's called a diametria. And what that is that there is a case going on, and I submit some testimony, which I've got to do in writing. and I swear this is true. And the question is, how does the court decide whether or not to accept it? And the answer, as I understand it, is that the court is supposed to treat my testimony as true until I have myself been prosecuted for false testimony. And that in the early period, it sounds as though the trial sort of stops while there's a second trial to determine whether my testimony is false. If I win that, then the court is supposed to treat that testimony as true. If I lose it, they don't. But in the later period, what happens is they continue with the trial on the assumption that my testimony is true, I think. This is what he seems to be describing. I'm not sure if it really happens. If the defendant is convicted and owes a fine, he pays the fine. Then the defendant sues the witness for false testimony. And if the witness is convicted, the witness must reimburse the defendant for the fine that he had to pay. I think that's what's happening. Now, if the verdict is execution, this would be a little harder to manage. And so I think what's happening is that for any verdict that isn't a money fine, they give the verdict and then they postpone the implementation of the verdict until the second trial is over and has been determined. And I'm not sure, but I think that's what they're describing. But it occurred to me looking at it that the general issue is an issue we face too. That you have testimony. How do we deal with the question of whether testimony is true or false? What are our mechanisms?
Cross-examination.
That's right. They don't have cross-examination. All right? Their testimony is being given in writing, and all you're asking the witness is this true? Is this what you really wrote?
Right.
Or testimony of a slave under torture, is this what you observed the slave to say? Because the slave doesn't actually testify itself. So they don't have cross-examination. And what else do we have? We have rules about what's admissible, as do they. Hearsay isn't admissible in their system either. But we also have, but don't much use, perjury. All right, there can be a second trial in our system too. You can be tried for perjury because you introduced your evidence under oath. But my impression is that's a very uncommon pattern, although it can happen. But the main thing we have is the jury decides whether to believe you or not. All right, you have the cross-examination, and after cross-examination, the jury decides what weight to give to your testimony. Now, that may in fact be happening in the Athenian case as well. You can't tell. But if I understand what the book is claiming, at least in theory, the jurors are supposed to take your testimony simply as true up to the point where it has itself been tried. And that struck me as an interesting issue of sort of a different ways in which you can imagine doing it. And yep.
Well, one difference in our system is that we have this very elaborate process of forcing both sides to reveal to each other what arguments and main lines of attack they're going to use during the trial and the evidence for it, and that allows you the time both sides to tear down that evidence.
Yes.
And
the Athenians have a version of that in some subset of cases, that there are some cases which go to an arbitrator. But then the arbitrator's verdict can be appealed to a court trial by either party. And the rule in those, if I understand it, is that in the court trial, you cannot introduce any evidence that wasn't introduced in the arbitration. So that looks like a mechanism for getting the same effect as a discovery kind of approach in our system. And that struck me as sort of one of the intriguing things. Look at some of the other things that it struck me as intriguing. Oh, they also have subpoena the witnesses. That is to say, you can require somebody to testify, and you can charge him with the crime of failing to testify. The only exception, interestingly enough, is that if you are convicted three times of false testimony, you are then, I think, deprived of citizenship, if I've got it right. Maybe deprived of some of the rights of citizenship, but a very serious penalty. If you have twice been convicted of false testimony, you may then decline a subpoena. Right? So I say, look, if you force me to testify, either I got to betray my friend because I actually did see him commit the crime you're charging him with, or I've got to lie to you and suffer this very serious penalty when you catch me. So don't make me testify. And oddly enough, they in fact accepted that argument, as I understand it, and didn't make someone testify under those circumstances. Another Another bit that sort of intrigued me, which again corresponds to, I think, a different solution. How do we handle, it's an interesting question, how do we handle a situation where one party says, I'm sorry, I can't make it to the trial date? Right? Suppose I'm charged with something, it's interesting, though, of course, my lawyer could make it without me, right? That is, think about a case where my presence is required and I have a possibly good excuse. I'm in the hospital. I'm out of the country and can't make it back in time, something like that. How do we decide whether those excuses are accepted, whether the trial date gets changed? Anybody know?
It's discretion of the judge.
So in our case, it's the judge decides. Whereas in the Athenian case, if one of the two parties to a case doesn't show up, but the other party sends somebody with a message saying, I'm sorry, I couldn't come, I was sick, or I'm out of town at the moment, what then happens is the jury decides whether or not the excuse is acceptable. If the excuse is acceptable, you postpone the trial to a later time. If the excuse is not acceptable, then the other party wins the case. If the prosecutor is the person who is absent, he gets fined. So that presumably is partly a precaution against the abusive prosecution device that we discussed before, providing he can't persuade the jury that he's, again, we don't know. One of the things that intrigued me reading on a personal interest in your reaction to this whole question of slaves testifying. Because apparently I'm told it was the rule not only in Greek law but in Roman law, that the testimony of slaves could only be taken under torture. And the question is, what's going on? And the obvious argument for the requirement is that you can't trust a slave because his master has too much influence over him. That presumably in the typical case, the slave is the slave of either the defendant most often, or someone associated with the defendant, either friend or enemy. So the slave is going to say whatever his master tells him to say, so we can't trust him. But then the question is, how does torture solve that problem? Because the obvious response is, the slave will do his best to figure out what the torturer wants him to say and say that. Or, if the slave is a really tough guy, he'll keep on saying what his master wants to say. Accept the present pain instead of the future pain, so to speak. So anyone have any guess at what's going on? Why are these sophisticated, intelligent people who've looked at the arguments doing this? But part of that is one answer. The case where torture does make sense is where you're going to have some way of confirming the testimony. So if you're torturing somebody to say where the loot was hidden, if he tells you where the loot was hidden, you go, you dig, and there it is, aha, it's telling the truth. And the standard hypothetical that people always use when they want to defend the use of torture, which is the one where there's a bomb, preferably an atomic bomb, with a timing thing in the middle of New York, and you've caught the guy who placed it there, and you've got 3 hours before it goes out, are you entitled to do whatever you can to make him tell you? And the obvious response is, morally speaking, you are entitled to torture him, but that is such an unlikely set of circumstances that we don't want it to be legal. Torture him, you will then be tried for torturing him. Quite likely the jury will decide to acquit you on the grounds that they don't think it was a crime, but don't make it legal. I mean, that seems to be a reason.
We're going to talk about this in the Chinese legal system, but in the Chinese law, as I understand it, as my Gulag writes, you can torture someone in order to get a confession, but if you kill the person, then you yourself are subject to the death penalty.
Von Gulick certainly describes that in one of his.
The Chinese regard torture as extremely effective at producing the truth.
But they also torture witnesses.
Yes.
And who aren't defendants. Yes. So both. But it seems to me that the best sense I can make of it in the case where you're not going to get confirmation is that you believe, perhaps correctly, that the interrogator can recognize lies. If you say, look, lying isn't easy. When you're being tortured, it's even harder. You know, you're in pain. You're upset. Maybe the theory is that the slave gives a series of lies, and I keep torturing him because I can tell that they're lies. And eventually, he tells the truth, and I stop. And that's the only way I can think of giving a plausible version. But I'm not in a society which accepts torture as a normal part of its judicial procedures. Pache, some extreme cases in the war on terror, and so I'm not very expert on this subject. And maybe it's true. Maybe that society that would do this, that the interrogator really can learn most of the time. to tell when the guy is finally telling the truth. I don't know. Sorry. So read the chapter and we'll discuss more of this stuff next time.